Good morning, everyone. We're ready to begin today on this beautiful spring day. Do we think spring has sprung here in Chicago? We hope so, at least. But we'll start with the first case of the day, Sayart versus Yahoo. Mr. Sayart. And that's case number 093379. And did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yes, you did, Your Honor.
All right. You may proceed.
If it please the court, my name is Gregory Sayart, and I represent the plaintiff, Beverly Sayart, in this matter. She filed an action in the district court in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She filed it under the Lanham Act, Section 43A, which prohibits false endorsements. She also alleged a violation of her rights under Wisconsin law for invasion of privacy. The district court, without any trial or even any discovery, dismissed her complaint. The district court concluded that she did not show that she possessed prudential standing under the Lanham Act. The standard on a motion to dismiss is whether the allegations of the complaint, taken as true, show that the plaintiff has a plausible right to recovery. Given this liberal standard, it is admitted that the allegations of the complaint do establish that Beverly Sayart had prudential standing.
Well, let me ask you this. What are your best facts that would demonstrate your intent to commercialize her identity for purposes of prudential standing?
Well, according to the complaint, number one, she is involved in public advocacy on behalf of the humane treatment of animals. And there's been a number of cases involving environmental groups, political parties, fraternal and religious organizations, and these entities do not engage in profit-making activity, and they do not place products into the stream of commerce, but they still have been held subject to Section 43A. So that would be one prong of my argument. Secondly, she has an Internet presence. She's written a number of scholarly articles on the Internet dealing with American Indian genealogy. Those are on a third-party website, and they generated over 17,000 views in the last 3 years. So my client has an Internet presence. She also has posted several copyrighted poems on the Internet dealing with animal rights. And she has a distinctive and unique personal name. Her name is entitled to protection of the Lanham Act. There are no multiple meanings for Bev Sayart. So I think those core facts, which are all in the complaint, would certainly create the inference that she has a plausible right to relief under the Lanham Act.
Well, but when you mentioned some of those cases that involve not-for-profits, but some advocacy groups have been found to engage in commercial activities, but there are no cases where such a group's commercial activities have been imputed to individual members, are there?
I'm not aware of a specific case that I can cite to you, but all these groups, of course.
Let me just make sure I understand the complaint, because in the complaint, she only alleges membership in online groups dedicated to animal protection and genealogy, right?
That's correct. But as I started to say, all these groups operate through the members. If they didn't have their members, they wouldn't be around, and they rely on the volunteer activities of their members. So
every member would have standing then.
If their name, if they have an Internet presence, yes, and if they have a unique and distinctive personal name, those
so
facts
Jones
have to be.
Or Smith or something, they're not going to be able to.
I don't think so. I think the problem with Smith is that we create too many associations. There's probably 50 Smiths in Wisconsin at the very minimum, and the United States there'd probably be 10,000 Smiths. In her complaint, which has to be taken as true, there's only one Beverly Sayart that refers to her and only to her.
But the problem is here, she's not alleged, you haven't alleged that she's the public face of any of these campaigns or that her identity was used to get support for any of these organizations.
That's true.
And that's a critical factor.
But you have to recall, though, under Section 43A of the Lanham Act, you don't need to have competing products. In the Double Mule case, the court here dealt with the issue of standing, and it said that the person had to be a commercial party, and they had to have a reasonable interest under the Lanham Act to seek protection.
Counsel,
she is a commercial party, even though she's not engaged in profit-making activity.
Wasn't the problem really with the Dovermule case is the family had sold that intellectual property right years
before? That's correct, Your Honor. And, of course, my client has never sold the rights to her name. She's used her name on the Internet for many years, and she's built up a following on the Internet.
But Dovermule is subject to a much narrower reading, and that is whatever they may have had, they sold. That is, when they had the home building business or whatever it was, the Dovermule family.
That's true, Your Honor, but the court in Dovermule indicated there should be a liberal interpretation of the word standing. They said that in the Second Circuit they had relied on only a competitor could have standing, and the Seventh Circuit in Dovermule said that was too narrow a view of the law.
You're referring to Cooligan.
Correct. That's from the Second Circuit. I think in that case they said that only consumers could not have any standing. The point I'm trying to make is my client is more than just a consumer or a member of the public because of her Internet presence, the unique use of her name, and the use of her name in these animal rights activities to support the humane treatment of animals.
Well, but then even if you get over those hurdles, in terms of damages, you know, what actual or likely harm has she experienced as a result of Yahoo's or Various's actions? You know,
well, it would include damages to her ability to control her name on the Internet. Even somebody involved in what you would call a political speech or non-commercial speech has to have a good name to do those activities.
Is that what defamation laws are for, Counsel?
In part, they're true. But you have to keep in mind she had some counts under Wisconsin law for invasion of privacy, and you can recover emotional distress damages for invasion of privacy. I'd rather recur the court to the case of Tom Waits versus Frito-Lay. That's a 1992 case from the Ninth Circuit. The plaintiff in that case had his name used in a radio commercial. He recovered $100,000 for false endorsement and $200,000 for emotional distress, and that case was cited with approval by the Seventh Circuit in the Heath case. So what I'm suggesting to you is, in a proper case, a person could recover damages under the Lanham Act, and they also could recover damages under state law for emotional distress.
But that's not the situation we have here, because here, understandably, she's upset that, you know, her name is associated with these materials, and clearly it's understandable what her emotional reaction is. But you haven't provided us anything more concrete than that. And so isn't that just defamation?
Well, no, it isn't just defamation. She's using her name to promote animal rights activities, the humane treatment of animals. She's involved in a number of activities. A lot of those aren't in the complaint because...
Let me stop you there for a minute. The problem is she's not, as I said, she's not the face of any of these organizations. She's not the leader of any of these organizations. Her name is not out there as the spokesperson or anything, and that gets back to our earlier discussion. I think that's a problem.
Okay, well, I would disagree respectively. She has, in her community, she's leading organizations, she signs petitions, she visits businesses. A lot of that is in the complaint because we don't have to put all our evidence in the complaint. But she is a spokesperson, and she has an Internet following.
Let me ask you this, though. What about this Nigel Barker? You agree that his level of participation in the SEAL campaign is substantially greater and more recognizable than your client.
That's correct, but remember my client's poems. They have been used by several organizations, Danish websites, that's in the complaint, as the frontispiece on their website to promote animal rights activities. And her name and her poem is the first thing you see when you go on these Danish websites. So she, in that sense, she does have a commercialization of her name. I think it's a matter of degree. Where do you draw the line? Where is somebody a celebrity and when they're not a celebrity? The Lanham Act doesn't require you to be a celebrity. It requires you to have some degree of notoriety, and certainly in the areas of animal rights and certainly in the areas of Native American genealogy, my client has a following.
Well, what other public activities besides posting messages on online forums has she been involved in with respect to animal protection?
Regretfully, those are
Let me just finish my question first, then you can speak. So what I want to know is, what other public activities besides posting messages on online forums
She's participated
she
in demonstrations
in?
At restaurants. She's gone and signed petitions. She's contacted congressmen and senators to promote legislation. She's done some fundraising. All this activity in relation to animal rights.
And let me ask you this. Any of that, those visits she's made or the picketing, have any of those been the subject of newspaper articles or TV reports where she's named?
Yes, they have, and they've also been on the Internet. And again, we didn't put all our evidence into the complaint, as you understandable.
So you're saying that her name has been used in TV reports and in newspaper
articles? As being a participant in a demonstration, she's been interviewed. She's been, her picture's been there. And then some of these organizations, when the demonstration is over, they'll use her name or her picture saying that she's supported, and she's gotten awards and plaques and thank yous, and some of these are on the Internet as well. So as I started to say, I think it's a matter of degree. Where do you draw the line? I think the law should encourage someone to get involved in these activities to build up their name, and who can argue with the inhumane treatment of animals as an example?
Well, one of the things she participated in was boycotting Canadian seafood products, correct? So is anyone who makes a personal pledge against buying Canadian products considered a member of this group? And would that person also have commercial interests in their identity based on participation in the boycott?
Okay, that's a two-part question. The first part was, just because they supported the boycott, they don't have to join the organization. That was by the Humane Society. But she does more than that. She visits businesses to have them sign the pledge to avoid Canadian products or Canadian seafood. And she's actively involved. And she represents herself. I'm Bev Stair. I'm here to sign you up for the Humane Society's boycott of seafood. And she uses her name. She doesn't hide her name. She's actively involved. It's her. She doesn't say, I'm with the Humane Society. She says, I'm Bev Stair with the Humane Society. And I said she's received commendations from the Humane Society from time to time for activities.
And those commendations she's received, have those been the subject of any TV reports or newspaper articles?
I believe those have not been, Your Honor. But I would emphasize, the law should encourage somebody to involve themselves in these activities to build up their name. And I mentioned also these posts on her the website involving Native American genealogy. They've generated over 17,000 views in the last 3 years. So she has an Internet presence, and somebody's going to be looking on the Internet for her and for her activities. And then to find this stuff on the Internet, which has no connection with her, it can hurt her in her genealogy activities, and it can hurt her in her activities on behalf of the humane treatment of animals.
But of course, right now, you don't have any evidence or proof of that, and you haven't been able to allege that in a complaint.
I don't think it's speculative, but we couldn't put all our evidence into the complaint.
Well, but wouldn't that be a critical piece of evidence to put in, the actual harm that she has experienced, if she's experienced some harm, given what your burden is?
Well, the harm is likelihood of confusion. People are going to assume that she is connected with these products and services, then that is in the complaint. That by itself is harm within the meaning of the Lanham Act.
You're saying this is a fact question?
Correct. And the extent of the harm would go to the damages, and it also would go to the type of relief that she can get. You don't always get monetary damages of the Lanham Act. Sometimes you get an injunction. Sometimes you get other relief. Sometimes you get the defendant's profits. We didn't get very far in this case to really go into that. But I think it's clear on the face of the complaint that she's been damaged. That's what when you have a trademark violation, you don't have to show the bad intent of the defendant. You just have to show what happened. And if they're misusing her name on these websites, that's sufficient at least to state a cause of action.
Well, that misuse, though, that took a pretty strenuous effort to meander through the Internet to come up with these things. When it says stop, you go through barriers. It seems that was I guess anybody put anybody's name up there, and you could keep bouncing around until you found something you didn't like.
Well, actually, some courts have held that it's easier to show harm on the Internet because people are more likely to be confused. It just takes a click to go from one website to another, and you would be less likely to realize that you're not connected with the first website when, in fact, the implication from the endorsement is that you are, Section 43A.
Now, you're into your rebuttal time. I don't know if you want to say – you're welcome to continue, but you might want to save some time.
Thank you.
Mr. Janetsky.
May it please the Court, my name is Christian Janetsky. I'm here on behalf of the appellee, Yahoo. This appeal concerns a private citizen's attempt to transform her displeasure with statements made by non-parties to this litigation on the Internet that she found personally offensive into a Lanham Act claim for commercial false endorsement against an Internet search engine that she used to find the offending third-party content. In short, as Your Honor's questions have gone to during Mr. Stater's argument, the appellant here has asserted the wrong claim against the wrong defendant in the wrong court for the harm that she alleges. I think the rule that appellant would have this court endorse is that any citizen who's engaged in the types of activities that all citizens are engaged in to one extent or another, that runs an Internet search for their own name and finds a search result that points to a third-party site that says something that's inconsistent with their view of themselves, would have a claim under the Lanham Act for commercial false endorsement. And I don't believe that that Congress passed the Lanham Act to address these sorts of personal reputational harms. That's a defamation claim or a false light claim under state law. It's not the kind of commercial interest that the Lanham Act was designed to protect.
Can we turn to the immunity question? I just want to make sure I understand your position clearly. Is it your position that search engines like Yahoo are always immune from suit under the Communications Decency Act?
No, Your Honor. That search engines like Yahoo are indisputably do act in the course of their normal activities as interactive computer service providers under Section 230 of the CDA when they publish information that is provided by third parties. That's what is at issue in this case. We would not dispute that if Yahoo itself publishes information, uses someone else's trademark to endorse Yahoo's own products or services on its homepage, and Yahoo is the speaker or the publisher of its own information, that the Section 230 would not apply.
Yes. You would find the snippets are not enough, I take it.
Yes, Your Honor. I think even under the allegations in the complaint that the appellant filed in this case, those allegations are that the snippets, as appellant refers to them, are summaries of the content on the third-party websites.
Provided by the contributor.
Provided by the third party.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor.
Here, the question I have, and I broached it with your opponent, is the dismissal of this on issues that appear at least in part to be factual issues. And in your brief, for example, when discussing the degree of celebrity necessary to claim, even under a broader test, commercial misuse, you talk about the Pacina case. And in discussing the Pacina case, you note that Pacina's own expert had conceded that the plaintiff's identity lacked that degree of celebrity. That really is a fact question. And then again, in discussing the likelihood of confusion and that nice issue of whether or not the plaintiff pled themselves out of court by pleading that the plaintiff is not engaged in this kind of conduct that she's associated with on the website. In responding to that, you talk about Mizakowski, and that was a case here in this court where you talk about 18 affidavits that were submitted that weren't enough to obviate a claim of confusion. That, again, was a summary judgment disposition. Aren't we a little bit ahead of ourselves here?
I don't think we are, Your Honor, because under Twombly and Iqbal, the duty of the plaintiff is to allege facts rather than mere recitations. It's not sufficient to allege there was likelihood of confusion in this case or to allege plaintiff has a commercial interest in her name without alleging underlying facts, which we have to accept it as true at this stage, that the plaintiff had commercialized her name. And, in fact, here on the commercial interest issue, plaintiff has alleged the opposite and argued again today. Here her counsel has argued again today that Ms. Stater never made any attempt. She explicitly has not ever sold or been paid for endorsement for her name. She's not commercialized it in any sense. And on the likelihood of confusion point, there's no allegation in the complaint that any consumer was ever confused by the third-party use, nor that any consumer ever ran a search for Bev Stater or ever viewed the results. The only person who viewed them is...
Except the reason given, it seems, at the lower court level was that confusion was, as I said, was obviated because the plaintiff pled that the plaintiff never committed that kind of conduct or any action that would reasonably associate it with that kind of conduct. And the trial court judge said, well, you pledged yourself out of court, at least as to that issue, it seems.
Yes, that was my next point. I believe that the appellant pled herself out of court on the commercial issue by pleading that she's never commercialized her name or sought to and has no intention.
I'm talking about the confusion issue.
And on the confusion, the same, there's a separate paragraph in the complaint, which as the district court, we believe, properly recognized. She also pled herself out there by saying her name has no association whatsoever with the context in which it's used here.
Of course, your opponent's response was, then how do you plead that it's false? How do you plead that it is a misstatement of her identity?
The Lanham Act and the cases, many of the cases that both the district court cites and that are cited in the parties' briefs, address that the purpose of the Lanham Act, the animating purpose of the Act, is to address competitive and commercial injury. Taking someone's brand that they have built up in a context and then adopting that brand to take either sell a product or advocate a position. And I think that the cases that probably best flesh this out are the cases cited by appellant involving the nonprofit organizations who are dedicated to a cause and have, over years of building memberships and through advocacy activities, established a brand name and a mark associated with, in the Ohio Committee for the Desert, saving the deserts in Ohio. The third-party use that is a false endorsement is an endorsement taking a position antithetical to the one that the Idaho Committee has established over time that it's associated with. So the falsity there is that Idaho Committee would not take this position on an issue for which their name is closely associated in the minds of consumers. And I think the allegations here fall well short of that and, in fact, plead the appellant out of court.
One of your arguments is that Yahoo did not use a plaintiff's name in connection with its goods and services. It merely recited content created by third parties. If Yahoo's goods are not the search results it provides, then what is Yahoo selling?
Yahoo's services, one of their services is to provide search results, help users find search results on the Internet. But the use of plaintiff's name, plaintiff's appearance in a search result is not endorsing that Beverly Stayart believes that Yahoo's search engine is the best search engine on the market. It's simply pulling content from a third-party website. The third parties may be endorsing, may be trying to claim that Bev Stayart is associated in some way with their content, but Yahoo is not representing in any way that the search results are associated with Yahoo's own products and services. I would just point out, Your Honors, that in addition to the commercial interest and likelihood of confusion, I think we've touched on all four bases that we believe the district court correctly found each independently would foreclose the claims brought by appellant in this case, which are better pled as state law defamation claims because they don't address commercial interests. If the court does not have,
you want to address the issue of the state law claims and now the absence of pendant jurisdiction and whether or not an opportunity to replead diversity jurisdiction should be afforded. The statute permits attorney's fees, does it not? The Indiana statute permits attorney's fees and punitive damages. It would seem the $75,000 requirement could be very easily met.
Two points on that, Your Honor. Both are outside the record, but to address your question. The question may be mooted by the fact that Ms. Stayart has filed a second complaint in Wisconsin District Court.
I'm sorry, I said Indiana. Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin.
We shouldn't apply Indiana law. We all agree, right?
Agreed. Ms. Stayart has filed a second action against Yahoo in federal district court in Wisconsin, alleging the same two Wisconsin state law claims and alleging diversity jurisdiction. To address the attorney's fees point, Yahoo's filed a motion to dismiss in that action on a number of bases, one of which is that the attorney's fees have to have been accumulated at the time of filing. Mm-hmm. And we don't believe that the attorney's fees could possibly have reached $75,000 at the time of filing.
I see.
No other questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Rothkin.
Mm-hmm. Good morning, Your Honors. Ira Rothkin for Various Incorporated. I'll also refer to Various as Friend Finder. Your Honor, Friend Finder does embrace the arguments that were made by Yahoo. Friend Finder also believes that its case here is actually very compelling when you look at the four corners of the complaint in the trial court. And here the facts are important, as Your Honor indicated, because the plaintiff made a strenuous effort to somehow involve Friend Finder in this case. You have, under the four corners of the complaint, a huge number of snippets from Yahoo search results for the term BevStayArt. And then out of one of those results, to some URL that includes the word jewelry spelled incorrectly in it with a .pl domain name, which the court could take judicial notice of. I hope that it's Poland. It leads to a page where there happens to be the manifestation of a Friend Finder banner ad. Now, the plaintiff in their complaint did not click on a hyperlink to get to that page. If you read the complaint carefully, what the plaintiff did was looked at one of the snippets. It was not clickable. The part that was clickable wouldn't have taken them to that page. And they opened up another browser and then typed in a long URL in another browser, which ultimately led them over to this jewelry page, which seems to be the core source of their complaint.
Can I ask go ahead. Okay.
At this stage of the litigation, how can we say with certainty that Various did not create the adult Friend or Finder advertisements that the plaintiff is objecting to?
Your Honor, I think that the way that we would like the court to consider this would be that Friend Finder could have created the actual advertisements, because if you looked at the source code that was included as Exhibit MM in the appendix, which is attached to the complaint, the source code does show a deep link to the Friend Finder site. So I think that the actual advertisement could have come from Friend Finder product. But the cause of action in this case is squarely around the URL that consists of the jewelry term with a long string that ultimately leads to bevstayart.html.
And that was provided by Friend Finder?
That was not alleged in the complaint to have been created by Friend Finder, and that is the reason why Friend Finder believes that they have CDA immunity, because they were not the creator of the content, which is the core of the cause of action right here, the wrongful, alleged wrongful content. Now, even if Friend Finder was the creator of the alleged wrongful content, which is this long URL, we have done a search and we could find no case in the United States of America, and I'd be glad to be corrected on this, that would say that that's a use in commerce. When you go past the domain name and go all the way to the end of the URL, post-domain path, I would argue that that's not a fair indicator of any source, that it's used for internal, computer directory structure. And so I don't think, Your Honor, that I would urge the court to find that that would not be a use in commerce in terms of indicating a source of origin. Now, furthermore, it was alleged in the complaint that somehow Bev Stayart's name on this third-party page in Poland was in the title tags. But, Your Honors, when you look at the complaint and look at the exhibits MM and you look at the source code, the word title tag or titles with a slash next to it shows under construction. So the complaint's internally inconsistent, and I would urge the court to look at the actual exhibit that's attached as opposed to the allegations and see that under construction is the title tag, that the name of the HTML file may be Bev Stayart, but there's no outward manifestation of that to the general public when they go and visit the webpage other than what's in the URL. That's not the title tag. So you have a situation where there are no title tags, no working hyperlink, and we would respectfully urge the court to find that there's been no Lanham Act violation or false endorsement violation. And there's no cases we could find to support the notion that a URL Post-domain is a use in commerce of the mark. Do Your Honors have any questions at all? Okay.
No questions?
Thank you very much.
And how much time does Mr. Sayre have? 2 minutes, Mr. Sayre.
Mr. Rothkin's argument first. Beth Sterrett's name is used in the title tag of the source code. That's Exhibit MM. That wasn't something that was done accidental. And the actual content on the website itself says, find adult Friend Finder members near Janesville. That's about 20 miles from my client's residence, and her name is in the title tag on the her name is in the post domain path of the URL. Secondly, if there's any inconsistency on a motion to dismiss, it's supposed to be resolved in favor of the plaintiff, not in favor of the defendant. With regard to Mr. Janetsky's arguments, Bev Steard in her complaint never said she never commercialized her name. Commercialization or commercial activity in the Lanham Act means simply advertising or promotion to influence the public in their buying decisions. And that's what she does every day as an animal rights activist. She's trying to promote animals and their fair treatment, and sometimes she has to be involved in commercial boycotts, which is the essence of commercial activity under the Lanham Act. That's all I have, Your Honor, unless there's some questions.
All right, thank you. We thank both counsel for their fine arguments. We'll take the case under advisement.